who me grew. Hi everybody, Ron Alcoholic. I don't know if I'm going to need the microphone or not, but
I'll see how it goes anyways. I'd like to welcome anybody new, anybody coming back, and Jules, welcome from out of town. Jeez, we're Facebook friends, and you live on the island, don't you? Welcome, welcome. And I'd like to welcome anybody new, welcome. My sobriety date's November the 3rd, 1988, and that doesn't make me any more important than anybody in this room. You know, I came in here just the same way as everybody in this room. And when I got here, you know, just to tell you just a little bit about myself, and I love that I have a little bit of time, so that's perfect. Hope you guys are willing to listen. It'll be exciting, so hold on to your seat. But I came in here just like everybody else. I came in here full of fear, and, you know, I didn't know what an alcoholic was, and, you know, I started drinking when I was like, I don't know, like 13 years old, 14 years old. I started the waterfront, so I'm a longshoreman. I've been a longshoreman since I've been 14 years old. I've been there like 36 years. I'm like 50 now, but, you know. So I started when I was 14 years old, and I was a longshoreman, and I drank with the guys. You know, I fit right in. They had alcohol there, and I'd work on like containers full of alcohol, and I would drink. And they had ships full of alcohol, and I would drink. You know, and I would drink at work, I would drink after work, I drank all the time. I didn't really know anybody who didn't drink, and I didn't want to hang out with you anyways if you didn't, you know. So I'm one of those drinkers you really wanted to see get sober, and if you think I was this loud when I was drunk, you're right, I was, and I could never drink at a bar. Like, I got kicked out of every bar I ever went to because it was too loud. So I was always getting off sales everywhere. So I know about drinking behind all the bars, right? That's where I was, right? And I was usually behind the Waldorf because that's where I work, is behind the Waldorf. But they even got tired of me there. So I slowly made it down to Main Street, you know, close down that place. And I'm one of these alcoholics who got so drunk, it didn't make sense. Like, I wasn't one of these smart ones. Like, if you're a smart alcoholic, maybe Norm was one of the smart ones. I wasn't, you know. And I'd get so drunk, I couldn't even make it home. I couldn't even walk from here to there, you know, because I was so drunk. So I was waking up many mornings. And where I would, all I knew is because I drank at an early age, right? 13, right? You know, at 14, and I'm drinking lots. That's like grade 8. You know, so all I could remember is getting kicked out of all of these schools, because I got kicked out of schools too. I wasn't a poster person for Alcoholics. Maybe I was back then, who knows? For Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know. But it wasn't good. Got kicked out of many schools. So when I drank, I knew where all these schools were because I got kicked out of them all. So everywhere I went, I knew there were schools everywhere because I went to them all, right? So why I'm saying that is because when I got drunk, I'd go to the parks, and at a lot of these schools in Vancouver, they have these kids' forts, right? That's where I'd go and drink, and that's where I'd go and pass out. But there's a problem with that, because in the morning, I would wake up, and I'd have, like, kids screaming, ah! And I would be screaming, and I'd be waking up, right? And here's kids, right? Mommy, why is somebody sleeping here? You know, and I'm like, oh, okay, I better go, right? So, you know, I could never, you know, control the alcohol ever. You know, I'm the guy you'd drink with or kill, one or the other. Even in AA, I'm the same way in AA. Either you just love me or you hate me, you know. And God, and if you hate me, hopefully you'll do the steps and, you know, oh my God, and then you'll love me, right? So anyways, that's a little bit about my drinking, and it didn't go well. Believe me, it didn't go well. And I finally one day asked for some help, and I got some help through my union. And I asked them for help. And some guy on the other end of the phone, he ended up being my sponsor. His name's Damon. And he said something over the phone. He said, can you quit just for today? And I'm like, that's a really silly question to ask somebody. I said, of course I can quit for today. But I said, where is it going to get me? He says, oh, you don't have to worry about where it's going to get you. He says, just quit for today. I said, okay. I said, I'm going to quit today. I said, I don't know about tomorrow. He says, don't worry about it. We'll get you some help tomorrow. So I said, okay, good. So he phoned me the next day. He says, are you still sober? I said, yeah. I said, of course I am. And you know what? I was like 100 pounds and I was dying. You know, I was so alcoholically sick at that time. It took me like 6 months to just stop shaking. I was really dying from alcoholism and from all the drugs that I was doing. But I'm not going to mention that. But I was dying from alcoholism, and I didn't even know it. And, you know, so I did quit the day, and he says, okay, I'm going to come and pick you up. And he says, just grab some clothes, and I'm going to take you somewhere. And he says, it's like detox or something. And I'm like, oh, good, okay, perfect. And they're going to help me? He said, yeah. And I said, perfect. And I'm thinking, like, swimming pool and stuff. So he picked me up, and we're on our way to this place called Detox, which I thought it was like the Betty Ford Clinic. On the way over there, I said, do they have swimming pools? He said, no. He said, you know, I said, like, they don't have swimming pools? I said, like, do they have hot tubs or anything there? I like, are they going to feed me? You know, and he said, oh, yeah. And am I allowed to smoke? And he said, yeah. So I said, well, it's not too bad then. Okay, I'm going to give it a try. So I went to Detox and I hated it. I hated it. And I wasn't right on Ron in Detox, believe me. I wasn't. I'm just like everybody else, and I hated everything. And I hated everything. And I was so full of fear, and I was filled with so much remorse and hate and hurt and no hope, no life. There was nothing left for me. There really wasn't nothing left for me at that point, and I really needed help. So he took me to this place, and I hated it. People were happy. What happened was this: people there, all I just remember is they went somewhere for an hour, and they came back, and they're all happy. And I said, what is wrong with you people? And they went to a meeting. They said, some sort of meeting. I said, well, that's weird. Whatever. So I phoned up my sponsor, and he had special privileges with the detoxes at that time. I said, this is just stupid. I said, you know what? The people here are crazy, and I don't even know why I'm here. I said, I'm leaving. I said, I don't even like it here. So he says, hey, why don't you wait, and I'm going to come and pick you up. So he had special privileges, and thank God he had special privileges to take me into Detox and take me out of Detox. He actually took me to a meeting on my very first, second day there. And I wanted to leave. I said, I have everything packed. You know, he said, oh, just leave your bag there, but I'm just going to take you somewhere. So he took me to a meeting that night. And I sat at the very back of the meeting. And it was at the Vancouver Recovery Club. And back then, it was like 710 Richards, and pipes would be dripping on your head. It was a horrible place. It was. Like, where is he taking me? But I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that day on, something happened to me. Something happened that never happened to me in my life for a long, long time. And they gave me hope. And to give hope to an alcoholic is to give them everything. And I had nothing. I had nothing. But I had somebody up here saying that you don't ever have to drink again. You don't ever have to drink again. I never heard that. I always heard, let's have a drink. But I never heard anybody say, you never have to drink again, one day at a time. And I'm like, wow. Well, I wasn't the smartest one. So that really was amazing for me, to somebody saying that you don't have to drink one day at a time for the rest of your life. And I loved that. I actually fell in love with the meeting. I loved it so much, we hung around to the 11 o'clock meeting. Then I went back to Detox. And I drove them nuts. So I did, right? Because now you've given me hope. You've given me something I haven't had for a long time. And I get this. I get this in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get it every single day I wake up. I get that hope. I don't only get it in the rooms anymore. I get it all through the day. You know, I don't see things today like I used to. I used to always think that my life runs on what I think or from even what I see. But that's not really the case, or what I know. But it's not. My life consists today is what I do. It's not what you do. It's what I do daily. And that's what brings me to a really great place every day. But it wasn't like that at the beginning. So I went to the meetings, and I heard people sharing, and I loved it. But I was getting resentful in the rooms. I had people up here, and they looked good, and they had money, they had cigarettes. I had nothing. Try coming here having nothing, right? Nothing. No car, you know. I have like a bag of clothes, and that's it. That's all I had when I got here. Nothing. And I hated all of you, and you hated me, believe me. Because I was loud, I was inconsiderate. Norm knows. Yeah, hey, I would go to Mountain Highway. Probably one of the very first meetings I ever went to was Mountain Highway. And you know what? I was loud, but I didn't understand. Try being in this room and dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how you feel, because that's how I was. So what happened was, is I kind of caught on. I kind of liked a few things here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to tell you what I liked. I liked people that were happy, because I wasn't. I liked people who gave other people hope, and those kind of people were called something. And I'm like, what are you? And they mentioned a word, sponsor. I'm like, I like that, sponsor. I like that. So I started sponsoring people. Right? I thought it was a brilliant idea. I had 2 months sober. 2 months. And I'm around AA, and I'm like, oh, geez, you know what? I think we could help each other. I want to help you. And I started sponsoring people. And nothing will help you more into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous other than helping others. Or dying, right? And I was doing both. I was dying and I was trying to help others, right? So everything pointed me towards this book. And believe me, I'm going to get to the book because I got lots of time to talk about it. So, and you're willing to listen, maybe. Okay? But I know many have walked out halfway through. You know, oh God. So I'm in AA and I'm sponsoring people, and I have great sponsees today with almost 20 years of sobriety, and I have some with 1 day, and you know, I have some with months and years. My life is surrounded by love today, and it's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But sitting in these rooms dying doesn't help. And I know how many people actually die in these rooms. I see it all the time. I just got a call before I even get into the steps. I got a call just over this weekend from this mother because I'm right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a call from this mother, and she says, can you help me find my daughter? And she's missing, and she's on the streets of Vancouver. And I've done this many times before. And so over this weekend, I spent like 5 or 6 hours on the streets of Maine and Hastings looking for this daughter and her boyfriend and stuff, 20 and 22. And I'm still looking for them. But because I have so many connections today, I have a lot of connections with a lot of people from the detox, the homeless shelters, and the drug dealers, and from the people with sobriety, you know, and I have it right out there. And I'm going to find this girl. You know, and I have found everybody I pretty much look for on these streets, you know, just to help any way I can. But it wasn't always like this. Remember, I was sitting in these rooms dying, and I was screwing around, and I was telling you up at the podium here, is I'm doing my best. But how can you do your best to stay sober when you leave here and you want to die? And that's what was happening to me. And I didn't know why. So I got into the book. And I needed to stop this wanting to die business, because that's all I wanted to do. I got sober. I'm kind of happy. I'm grateful, but I want to die every single day, right? And it's no different than being drunk. So I got into these 12 steps, and these 12 steps absolutely changed my life. So I have to talk about the 12 steps. And, you know, it absolutely changed my mind. So I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I always thought an alcoholic was a person who went down to Maine and Hastings and who drank. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know we have these two symptoms. And you know what? These people talked about the symptoms, but you didn't explain it to me. Oh, I got these two symptoms. I got these two symptoms. Hey, I got the two symptoms. But what do they mean? Like, really, what do they mean? I'm going to tell you exactly what they mean. This mental obsession of the mind happens first, and it doesn't, but let's just start there. And my mind gets in the way, and it totally convinces me that it's okay to drink or it's not okay to drink. But once I have that obsession of the mind, pretty much nothing can stop me from drinking at that point except some sort of spiritual help. Okay, so I have this obsession of the mind, and that's the only thing my sponsee was telling me about it today, because things didn't go really well today, and he was telling me about this obsession of the mind, and a friend of mine drank today. And I said, but something's wrong. So anyways, let's get back to the symptoms. So I have this obsession of the mind. My mind lies to me. And the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So the main problem isn't the alcohol. So if anybody here who has an alcoholic problem and they think that's the problem, you're wrong. And if anybody's telling you that the main problem is alcohol, you're wrong. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So the main problem is my thinking. My thinking gets me to that drink. So the main problem isn't the alcohol. The main problem is my thinking. And it tells me that in the big book. So this isn't stuff that I've just brought up. This is stuff that's in the book. So there's the obsession of the mind. So once I start thinking about it, and pretty much I have no control other than God's help at that point, I don't care if it's a good idea. I don't care if it's a bad idea. I'm going to drink. I don't care what my sponsor says. I don't care how many sponsors I have. I don't care how cute a girlfriend I got. I don't care how much money I got in the bank. I'm drinking. And you're not going to do anything about it. And I'm going to drink. And I do drink. And once I have a drink, that phenomenal craving occurs. And what that phenomenal craving is, Bill Wilson says it's an allergy that will condemn you to die. So once you actually convince yourself, good or bad, to take a drink, you have a drink, and you can't control it, you're an alcoholic. And it all starts all over again, but it doesn't start with the obsession of the mind. And you might think it does, but it doesn't. It actually starts before I even think about drinking. Something happens to me before I even think about the obsession of the mind. Let's go with what Dr. Silkworth says. Something happens. And what happens is that irritable, restless, discontent. And that's what happens. So what happens is I'm so irritable, restless, discontent. I don't care if I'm, I don't care what's going on in my life. Something's happening where I'm spiritually not okay. So why did my sponsee drink today? Well, he drank today because he's spiritually not okay. And if you're not spiritually okay, it means you're in spiritual pain. And you're spiritually not okay. And that's the spiritual malady. That's that irritable, restless discontent. And they talk about that on page 52. But Dr. Silkworth talks about it, about that irritable, restless discontent. I'm irritable, restless, discontented. And he explains it that we can't even tell the difference between the truth and the false. What do they mean by that? I'm going to tell you exactly what they mean by that. I'm going to tell you. Is I didn't know what he was talking about, but what I found out by working the steps with hundreds of people, and the hundreds of people helping people go through this work and going through the big book, Dr. Silkworth was talking about the truth and the false, but the truth has always been inside us. The truth has always been inside our hearts, and it's always told us the truth. But my mind got in the way of that. Right? The main problem of the alcoholic center is in his mind. So what happens is if I would have, they talk about lack of power. That was our dilemma. Lack of power. Whenever you hear power in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're talking about God. And if you hear powerless, they're talking about lack of God. I was powerless. Lack of God. Lack of you listening to God. Right? So he was telling you can't tell the difference between the truth and false, because here by heart is saying, Ron, you shouldn't do it. Ron, you shouldn't do it. But my mind says, I don't care. Or maybe I do care, or I don't care, whatever. And I would start drinking, and I would start, and I would rely onto the lies instead of relying on the truth. And the truth has always been inside us, because on page 25, and we talk about God, yeah, you're going to hear about God. And it's going to bother you. And if you're agnostic or atheist, I'm going to love you. And I'm going to teach you something really quick, really fast right now. Is I go with what the big book says. And I'm not here to tell you who God is. Because how could I do that? But I'm going to tell you where God is. From the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks about on page 25. It says, our creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a place which is indeed miraculous. Like, God's always been within me. I just haven't tapped into that. Page 55 says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. God's within us. It's in our hearts. Why didn't I ever hear that when I went to meetings? Why didn't I ever read it well enough to know that God was, because I relied on you. I relied on you. I didn't drink because of you, but I relied on you. And you told me to phone you every day, and I'm going to stay sober. That didn't work. So I remind people, if you guys want truth telling you, phone every day, or you're going to drink. You're going to drink anyways. If you're relying on your sponsor, we need to trust God within us. At the back of the big book, Spiritual Experiences, they talk a whole bunch of wonderful stuff there. But at the very bottom of the page, it says, our members have tapped an unexpected inner resource, which we presently identify as a power greater than ourselves. So they're telling you where God is. Okay, so now there's the good news. So there's pretty much step one is, you know, my life became unmanageable. My life became unmanageable because of this spiritual malady. Right? And then, you know, we get to the second step. So, you know, am I an alcoholic? Before you can even go to step two, they ask you. They go, can you stop entirely? Can you control the amount that you can take? And if you can't, you're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual solution can fix. Are you an alcoholic? They're even asking you at that point, are you an alcoholic? That's where you stop. I've helped a lot of people through this work. I went to Al-Anon. Wherever I go, they want me to help them with the steps. So then I was helping Al-Anon for a while. And they were asking me to do the steps with them. And then they turned into alcoholics because they couldn't get past the first step. Yeah, I can't control it. Right? I wish I could control it, but I can't. He turned from Al-Anon right into an alcoholic that day. And then we could go further. And then we can get into the second step. And, you know, and the second step is, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I always thought the insanity was doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, but it's not. The insanity they're talking about is that somehow, someday, we will control our... You read it at the very beginning. That's the insanity. Right? That's the insanity that they're talking about. That a time's going to come that you can't control it, but you're going to think you can. What page is it on? It's on page 30. I know it is. And it says, and that's the insanity that someday, I don't know where it is, but I know the book. Okay? And that's the insanity that we're all going to come to that point that someday, somehow, we're going to be convinced that we can control and enjoy this drinking. It's the great obsession to every abnormal drinker. That's us. That's the insanity. That's the scariest part in the big book. They're going to tell you that you're going to think that it's okay. You know, and I know a few people here who have actually tried that. And it's not okay, right? And you are going to continue to drink into the gates of insanity or death, or you're going to get this spiritual way of life, right? You are. And it's so worth it. And then it brings us to the third step, you know, and it says the very beginning of step three is any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. But it says made a decision. A decision is a choice. It means I got a choice to turn my will in my life. My will is my thinking. My life is my actions. So I'm turning my thinking and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And it's within me. I want to live this way of life. And that's just the beginning. So here's the good news. Here's the good news. You know what the problem is my thinking. You know where the solution lies? The solution lies in my heart. Absolutely. Will you stay sober on that alone? Absolutely not. And I'm going to tell you why. It's because I got these defects of character that block me from God. And these defects of character block me. And what those defects are is, I don't like that loud guy. Don't like him. I have to love him, but I don't like him. You know, or, you know, that person cuts you off. And I'm like, ah, you know, but I don't react that way. So what I've done is my whole entire life is I've always reacted from what I thought. So we're going back to the beginning. I'm always reacting from what I think. And if you're reacting from what you think, you're doing it wrong. Right? Unless you've done this work. Because by the time you get to step 11, it says, oh, we gave you brains, we want you to use them. But that's only when you get to step 11. If you're not on step 11, you should not be thinking. Right? Right? You shouldn't. You should be doing this work. You should be doing the work. And you should be doing the work and getting the results from doing the work. No thinking's involved. So even Kathy mentioned step four, and it's great, step four. I tell people right away, no thinking. I don't want you thinking. You already know what blocks you. You already know those people. They're the closest ones to you. Write them down. You know, and I hear people, oh, I only got five. I'm like, oh, come on, let's get honest here, right? Come on. I could give you a six right now, right? So we get down to the work. So let's talk about step four. And I've learned a lot because I've studied this a lot. And step four, I have the resentments and why, and I have the cause and how it affects me. That's as far as most people get. And that's what the big book tells me. That's as far, oh, I don't like her because she won't go out with me or something. And that's as far as people get. And that's it. But we need to actually go further. And what the big book says is we actually have four mistakes. It talks about these four mistakes. Believe me, it does. And it talks about the four biggest mistakes that we can make. And that's our resentment. It's our selfishness. It's our fear. They actually added self-pity to that. Do you know why they added self-pity to the four main defects of character for our step four? It's because they knew we wanted stuff from you. Like, I want something from you. Or you want something from me. Or I want something from you. So they put, what did I just say? Is self-pity. They added self-pity to that. So that's one of our main defects of character and afraid. But it's a mistake. The big book says that these four things are a mistake. And they are a mistake. God does not want us afraid. So if you're here and if you have any kind of fear in your life right now, you're doing it wrong. Might as well just get into the book, right? Because the book tells me it's a mistake. I will show you if you read it. We look for our mistakes. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest. God doesn't want us dishonest and stuff. So we get that part. My part of that. So let's just say I'm resentful at Ron because he's too loud and he affects my personal relationship with him, right? So what's my mistake out of that? My mistake out of that would be is I'm selfish. But just because a kid's stealing from 7-Eleven or just because you're selfish, because why? Because I'm too loud. We need to go a little further than that. And what it says right after that, it says our wrongs. Something to do, I'm pretty sure it's our wrongs. And our wrongs are my defects of character. Like, I know you're stealing from 7-Eleven. I know you don't like Ron because he's selfish. I know you might be stealing from 7-Eleven. I know that you're dishonest. I want to know why. I want to know why. Write it down. I want to know why. I'm lazy. I'm inconsiderate. I'm mean. I'm avoiding him. I have all these defects of character, and all of these defects of characters block me from God. And they pull me further away from these rooms and from you. I had my sponsee the other day talking to me, and he says, I'm never going back to that meeting. That ain't going to work with me. It isn't. Right? Because we're not supposed to be getting actually resentments. Once you have done this work, you're not supposed to be getting resentments. Because you know why you're not supposed to get any resentments? And if you're getting any resentments, sorry about it, but you got to get back to the work. You're not supposed to be getting any resentments because it has nothing to do with you. My resentments against you have nothing to do with you. Your resentments towards me has nothing to do with me. It has to do with my whole entire life. I've been reacting from what I think. And I've been reacting wrong. And I've been reacting from what I think. Or let's go with I'm reacting from what I know. But it's not good enough. That's not going to help you. I need to get down to my defects of characters. And I need to write these defects of characters down. Okay, so then we do that. Then we make your list. And we go through all that list. Then we get to our fear. And our fear, you know, this is a real good one because if you ask anybody in the fellowship how they deal with fear, everybody's going to tell me the same thing. And what are you going to say? You're going to say it's faith. But faith is only half of it. And the big book tells me that. Faith is only half of it. I'm still going to be afraid to swim. Okay, so I'm going to pray. I'm afraid to swim. Oh, thank you. Oh, good. Oh, thank you. So let's just say I'm afraid to swim. And this is how the big book helps me out. And it's page 60. I'm pretty sure it's 68. And halfway down it, it said that we had these fears, and we had, why? I'm afraid to swim. Why? It's because I don't want to drown. But there's actually a solution there for every fear. And this is the solution to the fear in the big book, in the middle, and here's the solution. And it says, to direct our attention what God would have us be. That's the solution. I need to direct my attention what God would have me be. And what that is there's always, with any kind of fear, I need some sort of action. So I can pray all I want about swimming or heights or whatever the case might be, but nothing's going to change until I put some sort of action. I direct my attention to what God would have me be. So let's do that. God, direct my attention to what you would have me be with swimming. You know what God just told me? Swimming lessons. Right? What happens is now with every single fear, I got a solution. I direct my attention now in the big book. Do you know what it says right after? It's kind of exciting. So right after it says, direct our attention to what God would have us be. Right after it says this. It gets exciting. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. I'm not afraid of swimming any longer. I'm not afraid of heights anymore. And I'll tell you what I'll do with heights. I got the sunglasses, right? If you're ever on a gondola with me, we take the gondola up or down. I got the sunglasses on. I got my eyes closed for the first at least 5 minutes, right? Until I'm comfortable. And then, you know, so that's how we deal with fear. Okay, and then at the bottom of the page, you know, fear, bottom of the page, it says, all men who have faith have courage, they trust their God. And sometimes, you know, I found, you know, even 5% of some of the fears, there's really nothing you can do. And I'll give you an example. I have a fantastic sponsor. And I went to Mexico City, and he owns a couple of treatment centers in Mexico City. Just wonderful guy. Love him. And we were staying at this hotel, and he says, I have a surprise for you. And I'm like, oh boy, we have a surprise. So this was just a month and a half ago. So we went up to the 35th floor of our hotel, and there's a helicopter. And I'm like, uh-oh. And I'm like, okay. Oh, my heart's beating, and I'm kind of shaking. So he thought it would be a good thing. And it was really, truly nice. So we flew the helicopter to his other house or whatever. But I had to get in this helicopter on the 35th floor. And I'm terrified. And I don't think I had my glasses. And I didn't have glasses because I didn't know what was happening. So I'm in the co-pilot seat. And, you know, flying a helicopter, like, from maybe a beach all the way up. I've done that once. That was kind of okay. But, you know, flying off of the 35th floor in Mexico City and, like, just flying over and over and, like, almost dying. All men who have faith have courage. They trust their God. I kind of had to trust things at that point. You know, there was no action I could have taken other than not do it. But I trusted God and everything was fine. So then we get to the sex inventory. And, you know, the sex inventory, it's pretty laid out, pretty simple. And, you know, I have to do an inventory with every relationship I have. And I think the really most important part of that part is there's one question is, what should have I done instead? And what happens is if I go with every relationship with that and answer those questions, what should have I done instead gives me a clear picture of how I should be in a relationship now. And, you know, that's really important what I had to do there. And I have to remind people is, you know, we deal with sex abuse, child abuse, and all kinds. I've heard everything. I've heard everything you could ever imagine. And anything, like any horror story or person you can imagine, I've heard it all. And, you know, you have to remember that we're not at part or at fault in any of that. If any of that has happened to you, or if you've done any of that, maybe you have made a part. But you have played a part in it. And I'm going to tell you the part that we played in all of it. And it's, what should have I done instead, is I've held on to it for all these years. See, you're not at fault out of it. If something's bad's really happened to you, and you're not. But I've held on to it for this long, and I need to deal with it now. And this is where I deal with it in the sex inventory. And that's how I deal with it. So I talked to I'm only like a crane operator, but I go to many treatment centers, and I help many of the counselors and a lot of the people at a lot of these treatment centers. I actually just got hired to help part-time for the aftercare part with one of the places just recently. So there's your three lists that we have to do in step four, and I've got about 5 minutes left, so we're going to really try to do this quick, because we'll quit at 5:02. The last list is the list that nobody wants to do. This is the list that the harms that I have done others. Like, for instance, if I stole your cell phone, would you be pissed off? You'd be so resentful at me if I took your cell phone. You would be. You'd be resentful. I get it. What happens if you stole my cell phone? Would you be pissed off at me? Absolutely not. But you've harmed me. And people don't want to look at this list. You've harmed me, and I need to fix that. I need to have the list of the people that I need to fix things with from my step four. But I also harmed people that I'm not resentful at. But I need to fix this. Might be past relationships. It could be money. It could be whatever it is. But I need to fix this. I want to be able to live free. And this is where I do it in that last list. That's our step four. Then we go and we do step five. Then we do six and seven. After we do step five, we have all these defects of characters. I know exactly which ones they are because we actually count them. How many times have you used avoidance in your step four? How many times have you used like lying or judging me? Or judging people with every person? You get these patterns, and all of a sudden you mention judging 35 times. So what we do is we count them all up, is what I do. So by the time you get to step six, you know your defects of character very crystal clear. You know the ones that are blocking you from God. That's step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Step seven is knowing. Step six is knowing them. Step seven is when you're actually acting out on your defects and you don't want to act on them anymore. So you're asking for God's help. Look, God, I don't want to be mean and inconsiderate. I want to be kind and loving. God, help me be kind and loving. This is where step seven comes in. I want to be a better person today. That's step seven. I don't look at and I don't focus on the defects anymore. I focus on the solution. So we're getting a lot of solutions from all this work. And then we get to step eight. We made this list, the people we have harmed. We've done it in our step four. But we review it. And then step nine, and I'm nearly done now. I got about two more minutes. Step nine is probably one of the most important steps because it says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The most important person on this list is you. I want to know a game plan for you because there's no way that I'm going to come to you if I'm not okay with me. Why would I go out of my way to come to see you and talk to you and even spend a second with you if I hate everything about me? So self-care, self-love, loving you is the most important thing you can do for you in step nine. It is. I want to know a game plan. I want to know, are you going to start working out? Are you going to meetings? Are you going to phone your sponsor? Are you going to do the steps? Are you going to work? Am I going to be considerate and loving towards everybody? And what I have found is forgiveness is the biggest... Oh, just one more minute, okay? Forgiveness is the biggest thing in my life, and I know it is. It's the most important thing in our lives is to be forgiven and to be forgiven and have this forgiveness. But what does that look like? How do you do that? I'm going to tell you exactly how you do it. Is I've always reacted from what I think and from what I know, and it doesn't work. So step nine, I had to come to a place of forgiveness and what that looked like. And what that looks like and what that action looks like is to always, and I mean always, react with love. And when you react with love in every single situation in your life today, all of it, I don't care who it is, I don't care what they've done to you, it's no thinking involved. React with love with absolutely everything in your life. And it will change your life. Then you can go to others and make amends to them. And it can be kind, and it can be loving, and it can be spiritual, and it can be honest. Step 10 is done all through the day, so let's not confuse us, people. Step 10 is continues to take the steps, and it's step 10 is all through the day. Step 11 is done in the morning, and step 11 is done at night. And there's 9 questions to ask yourself every night. We all should be doing that. I do it. On one side, I have on the awakening. I turn it over. I answer the 9 questions. On step 11, I do that every night. And step 12 is go out and help others and give them the gift. How can we help others today? I believe there's only one way to help the alcoholic. Take them through the steps. Thanks for my sobriety.